I'd like to begin by giving you an example of the kind of dehumanizing, anti-Arab racist expression that was endemic in Israel several years before the first Palestinian suicide bombing and nearly two decades before the firing into southern Israel of homemade Qassam rockets. These quotes were taken from the Hebrew press and translated by Dr. Israel Shahak. Some of you might recall the late Dr. Shahak's amazing work. He was a chemistry professor in Israel, himself the survivor of two death camps, Nazi death camps. So the first comes from, these both come from the years of the First Intifada, which was an uprising of Palestinian civil society expressed through marches, demonstrations, graffiti, flags, economic strikes, the burning of tires, and the hurling of stones. All of these actions were considered civil disobedience, were acts of civil disobedience under Israeli military orders. Now, this racist expression came from the mouths of children. Zion Ben Kanan, a school headmaster, reported driving a bus near a West Bank settlement with children of the fourth and fifth grades. And now I'm reading the quote. Quote, "On the way, in front of the bus, 2, 4, or 5-year-old Arab boys were fighting. One of them fell down in the road. The children in the bus shouted at the driver, 'Run him over. He is an Arab. Crush him.' The general atmosphere among these children is that this is our land and that the Arab is not a human being. He is a primitive stone thrower who must be wiped out," end quote. So it came from the mouths of children. It also came from the mouths of youths who would shortly be joining the army. After two Palestinian workers were burned to death in the Tel Aviv suburb Or Yehuda, when the hut in which they were locked for the night was set on fire, the newspaper Ediyat Aharonot quoted a 16-year-old resident of the town as saying, quote, "What does it matter if an Arab burns? What does an Arab matter at all? It's not a human being. I wouldn't care if more than 2,000 burned," end quote. And it was sometimes given an official imprimatur. Quote, "On the wall of the office of a senior officer of the civil administration in the Gaza Strip, near the routine announcements of the Israeli army offices, photographs, a Swiss calendar, and wise sayings of the sages about what is love, the following poem was also hanging. Yes, it is true that I hate Arabs. I want to take them off the map. Yes, this is all my work. My life passes pleasurably. One shoots a bullet and a head is flying. It is a pleasure to feel when the bullet touches it, knocks into the head and the head splits. Then I feel liberated and even feel pleasure to see how the head is flying off. There are beautiful places in the territories. There is sea and sand and many palms. It is a pity that there are Arabs there too," end quote. So those are expressions from the late 80s. Let's flash forward to 2009. I imagine many of you followed the events in Geneva known as Durban 2, the conference held to evaluate progress toward the goals established by the first World Council Against Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance, which was held in Durban, South Africa in 2001. Since last September, the U.S. administration and Congress have worked assiduously to ensure that Durban 2 would not become the kind of Israel-bashing event it perceived Durban 1 to be. Apart from widely reported remarks made by the president of Iran, the U.S. seems to have succeeded at the official level. The day after Ahmadinejad's speech, 192 countries adopted a 16-page text from which all references to Israel, Palestine, and the Middle East had been removed. The text asserted, quote, "The Holocaust must never be forgotten," end quote. The only countries that were not present to sign on to this document were the U.S., Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Germany, Italy, Poland, and the Netherlands, which stayed away to protest the fact that this document endorsed the goals of Durban 1. And they were also opposed to a passage in the document condemning, quote, incitement to religious hatred, end quote, which they denounced as a blow to freedom of expression. Ironies abound. Thanks to the U.S. campaign to control the message, it was clear that freedom of expression was not going to be the conference's strong point. For months, the U.S. had worked on two fronts to get any language critical of Israel stripped from the draft document and to induce its allies to refuse to attend the conference if that was not achieved. It is also, of course, ironic that the U.S. in 2009, led by a black president, would lead a walkout from the World Conference Against Racism of most of the former colonial powers or white settler colonies. Given the broad scope of the 25 recommendations made to the State of Israel by the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, or CERD, in March 2007, it is difficult to see how Israel could be expected not to feature in a World Conference on Racism. The CERD document did not utter the loaded words, Zionism is racism. But there is no way Israel could carry out the committee's 25 recommendations without dismantling Zionism and the 20 or so laws that privilege its Jewish over its non-Jewish citizens. The committee wanted the right to equality and a ban on racial discrimination to be explicitly included in Israel's basic law. It wanted Israel to ensure that the definition of itself as a Jewish state did not result in any systematic distinction, exclusion, restriction, or preference based on race, color, descent, or national or ethnic origin. It wanted equality in the right to return to one's country and the possession of property. It wanted the World Zionist Organization, the Jewish Agency, and the Jewish National Front to stop managing land, housing, and services exclusively for the Jewish population. It wanted Israel to ensure that state land is allocated without discrimination. Today, 93% of Israel's land is defined as, quote, the inalienable property of the Jewish people, end quote. It wanted Israel to end segregation and discrimination in employment, housing, education, the criminal justice system, and religion, and prevent racially motivated offenses and hate speech. And turning to the Israeli occupation and ongoing colonization of Palestinian land, the CERD committee reiterated that Israeli settlements are illegal under international law, as is the wall where built in Palestinian territory. It condemned the severe restrictions on freedom of movement in the occupied territories that target a particular national and ethnic group, and the dual system of laws and practices applicable to Palestinians and Israelis in the West Bank. It urged Israel to protect Palestinians from violence perpetuated by Jewish settlers, and to prosecute those who perpetuate such attacks. In short, it wanted an end to the Zionist drive for greater Israel. Back in Switzerland on April 19, 2009, the day before the official part of Durban 2 got underway, several NGOs held an unofficial Israel Review conference, which focused on the applicability of the crime of apartheid to the State of Israel and the development of legal strategies for obtaining the accountability of Israel. Its organizers stressed that this examination of what has happened in Israel-Palestine since Durban 1 was especially critical, since any discussion of Israel's discriminatory and other practices towards Palestinians had been entirely excluded from the formal conference. The title of the review conference, quote, United Against Apartheid, Colonialism, and Occupation, end quote, shows a significant shift that has taken place over the past few years. No longer is the focus on Israel framed solely in terms of international humanitarian law governing military occupations, namely the Hague Regulations and the Fourth Geneva Convention. Within the UN, that shift in focus was signaled by reports written by South African jurist and human rights law professor John Dugard, who was UN Special Rapporteur for the Occupied Territories from 2000 to 2007. After Israel totally rejected the ruling of the 2004 International Court of Justice concerning the illegality of its separation wall where it was being built within the 1967 Green Line, this would include 85% of the West Bank wall. 85% of the wall has been built within that Green Line. Dugard felt it was pointless to recommend to the government of Israel that it show respect for human rights and international humanitarian law. That is his term, pointless. In his final report of January 2007, he broadened his framework of analysis to include, quote, colonialization, apartheid, and foreign occupation, stating that Israel's occupation, quote, contains elements of all three of these regimes, which is what makes occupied Palestinian territory of special concern to the international community, end quote. He briefly describes South African apartheid and then breaks new ground for a special rapporteur, quote, although the two regimes are different, Israel's laws and practices in the occupied Palestinian territory certainly resemble aspects of apartheid. They and probably fall within the scope of the 1973 International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid. What are the legal consequences when such a regime has acquired some of the characteristics of colonialism and apartheid? Does it continue to be a lawful regime? End quote. After suggesting that a new International Court of Justice advisory opinion might be needed to examine these questions, Dugard finishes his report with a paragraph that calls into question the future of the human rights movement. Quote, for years, the occupation of Palestine and apartheid in South Africa vied for attention from the international community. In 1994, apartheid came to an end, and Palestine became the only developing country in the world under the subjugation of a Western-affiliated regime. Herein lies its significance for the future of human rights. There are other regimes, particularly in the developing world, that suppress human rights, but there is no other case of a Western-affiliated regime that denies self-determination and human rights to a developing people and has done so for so long. If the West cannot demonstrate a real commitment to the human rights of the Palestinian people, he concludes, the entire international human rights movement, quote, will be endangered and placed in jeopardy, end quote. Now, Dugard's report was issued shortly after the publication of Jimmy Carter's book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, and he briefly references the book in his report. You may recall that the book caused a national outcry because of Carter's use of the word apartheid. Abraham Foxman, the national director of the Anti-Defamation League, declared that Carter used the word in the title, quote, to delegitimize Israel, because if Israel is like South Africa, it really doesn't deserve to be a democratic state, end quote. In the text, Carter describes one of the options facing Israel as, quote, a system of apartheid with two peoples occupying the same land but completely separate from each other, with Israelis totally dominant and suppressing by violence Palestinians of their basic human rights, end quote. Carter used the word apartheid only three times in the text and applied it only to the occupation, which he did indeed hope to delegitimize. He did not apply it to Israel itself, which he held up as the embodiment of, quote, the ancient culture and moral values of the Jewish people, end quote. He furthermore explicitly shielded Israel from the charge of racism. When critics attack Carter's tentative use of the apartheid analogy, they imply that he has entered a wholly new terrain beyond the bounds of all reasonable discourse and hence must be stopped in his tracks. But in fact, that terrain has been well traveled by scholars and activists who have for decades examined both the parallels between apartheid practices in South Africa and Israel and the relationship between Israel and apartheid South Africa. What is new is the movement that has been taking shape since the first Durban conference, and with new vigor since Israel's war on Gaza, behind an anti-apartheid banner. It is this that I believe accounts for the intensity of the attack on Carter. And in the rest of my remarks today, I want to very briefly examine the historical context underpinning the apartheid analogy, describe various ways the analogy has been interpreted, and then say something about the movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions that is gathering force internationally and here in the U.S. And in the process, I will highlight some similarities and differences between Israel's racist practices and the American experience. Now, there are obvious parallels between the American colonists of the 17th and 18th centuries, who regarded themselves as a chosen people sent from the old world to create a, quote, new Jerusalem in the wilderness, and the European settlers in Palestine, who, like the European settlers in southern Africa, claimed to be creating, quote, an outpost of civilization against barbarism, end quote, to quote the founder of political Zionism, Theodor Herzl. In 1917, when there were 56,000 Jews in Palestine and 644,000 Palestinian Arabs, David Ben-Gurion invoked a centuries-old colonial tradition by describing Zionist settlers as, quote, conquering a land. We were a company of conquistadors, end quote. This is not too many decades after settlers in the United States moved west in the name of manifest destiny to build a, quote, white man's country from sea to sea. The mentality behind the phrase attributed to Indian fighter General Phil Sheridan, the only good Indian is a dead Indian, resulted in the reduction of the indigenous population in the continental U.S. from an estimated 1 million at the start of European colonization to some 300,000 by 1800. Zionists and white South Africans also used draconian methods to deal with what both regarded as a demographic threat. In 1913, white settlers in South Africa had dealt with their demographic problem by passing a Lands Act, setting aside 93% of the best land for whites and only 7% for blacks, who made up 67% of the population. These scattered parcels of land, later increased to 13%, became the South African version of native reservations, known as Bantustans. In the Middle East, an estimated 750,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed when the State of Israel was founded in 1948, which, by the way, is the year that the system of apartheid became the official policy of the white South African government. And apartheid, I'm sure you know, is the Afrikaans word for apartness or separation, and it referred to a system of racial separation institutionalized to maintain the supremacy of whites over, quote unquote, non-whites. It reflects a belief that certain people are less human than others, the mentality that is clearly reflected in the quotes I read to you at the beginning of this talk. Israeli professor Benjamin Bet-Halachmi and other writers have described how fundamental similarities and a shared colonial outlook evolved into an intimate collaboration between Israel and apartheid South Africa, lasting more than 30 years, quote, a unique alliance, Bet-Halachmi called it, the most comprehensive and the most serious Israeli involvement anywhere in the world, end quote. The depth of these historical connections help explain why anti-apartheid activists and leaders in South Africa today are today in the forefront of the campaign to create a movement against Israeli apartheid. In Nelson Mandela's words, quote, we know too well that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians, end quote. The ties binding South Africa and Israel together operated at many different levels, people to people, economic, and above all, military. In 1976, South African Prime Minister John Vorster, a known Nazi collaborator, got the red carpet treatment when he paid an official state visit to Israel. By this time, there were already books in print tracing the affinities between Zionism and the, quote, civilizing mission of settler colonialism in South Africa, and laying out the role played by South Africa and South African Jewish community in the establishment of the Jewish state. South African Prime Minister Hendrik Verwoerd, the principal architect of apartheid, regarded both Israel and South Africa as practitioners of what he called separate development. Quote, this is Verwoerd, "The Jews took Israel from the Arabs after the Arabs had lived there for 1,000 years. Israel, like South Africa, is an apartheid state," end quote. In 1968, the Israeli government established a tourist office in South Africa, and hundreds of thousands of Israelis and South Africans subsequently visited each other's countries. While tourism to South Africa from the rest of the world declined, tourism from Israel kept growing year after year. Israelis vacationed, ran businesses, invested, and looked after security matters in the South African Bantustans, demonstrating a certain faith in the future of apartheid. The friendly relationship resulted in a network of sister city agreements between Tel Aviv and Johannesburg, Haifa and Cape Town, Eilat and Durban, and Ashkelon and Port Elizabeth. As the apartheid regime was being increasingly isolated by the international anti-apartheid movement, the friendship between South Africa and Israel was expressed through regular cultural contacts, sports tours, and exchange visits to universities and research establishments. In the aftermath of the 1967 war, an Israel-South African Friendship League was set up in Israel to promote trade, which almost doubled following the 1973 Israel-Arab War and expanded significantly after Prime Minister Voster's visit to Israel. The close relationship between the State of Israel and apartheid South Africa helped South Africa evade international sanctions and develop its arms industry. Now, the state of emergency, which South Africa declared in 1985, turned the world decisively against the apartheid regime and made the Israeli economic connection more vital than ever. So it really did help evade sanctions, the relationship with Israel. But it was in their military relations that Israel rendered South Africa its greatest service, enabling it to evade the United Nations arms embargo and form what James Adams, who was the defense correspondent of London's Sunday Times, called a, quote, joint arms industry, end quote. Israel also gave South Africa's security forces advanced lessons in the control of subversion based on its West Bank Gaza model. Intelligence agencies of both countries shared information and conducted joint operations. Now, both countries viewed their possession of nuclear weapons as the ultimate guarantee of their existence. By the 1970s, Israel and South Africa were collaborating in the development of their nuclear programs, and U.S. intelligence reported evidence of a joint Israel-South African nuclear test taking place on September 22, 1979. The U.S. government refused to investigate the nuclear relationship, despite the fact that neither Israel nor South Africa had signed the 1968 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and refused to allow their nuclear facilities to be inspected. The 1986 Anti-Apartheid Act required the U.S. president to report to Congress any violations of the U.N. arms embargo of South Africa, quote, with a view to terminating U.S. military assistance to those countries, end quote. In March 1987, Israel, by then the only country to maintain strategic relations with South Africa, forestalled such a report when its cabinet decided that it could not afford to be out of step with the international community. So it took measures, not sanctions, but it took measures limiting trade, sports contacts, and cultural ties in September 1987. 2 months later, Israel responded to the outbreak of the first Palestinian uprising by implementing what its defense minister, Yitzhak Rabin, called, quote, force, might, and beatings. The similarities between the repression in the occupied territories and what was happening under the South African state of emergency were now visible to the entire world. So given this shared history, we should not be surprised that the apartheid analogy was applied to Israel and its policies long before the publication of Jimmy Carter's book. That analogy has been applied in essentially four different ways. First, parallels were drawn between apartheid South Africa and the state of Israel itself. Nearly 20 years before Jimmy Carter outraged Abraham Foxman by coupling Palestine with apartheid in the title of his book, the Israeli scholar Uri Davis published Israel, an Apartheid State. Whereas Carter took pains to distance his use of the word from Israel within its 67 borders, Davis set out to demonstrate that despite obvious differences with the apartheid regime in South Africa, key structural distinctions in Israel in birth certificates and legal mechanisms governing access to citizenship and land for the categories of Jew and non-Jew, and the laws cementing Jewish dominance qualify as what he called a form of apartheid. I think there are some obvious problems with the analogy being used in this way. 20% of Israel's population are Palestinian, both Christian and Muslim, who, unlike black South Africans under apartheid, have citizenship, can vote, and take part in the Knesset. However, in Israel, not all citizens are equal before the law. There is a distinction between citizenship and nationality, and Israel's Jewish citizens are privileged by virtue of their Jewish nationality that gives them additional rights under the law of return and the citizenship law. The pervasive discrimination and conditions of segregation faced by Israel's Palestinian citizens are comparable to the African-American experience under Jim Crow segregation. Like Palestinian Israelis, African-Americans were citizens for whom separate could never be equal. And when I say separate, you know, within Israel, their Palestinian municipalities only get 3.5% of the municipal budgetary allocation. This applies to schools. I mean, there's a pervasive inequality. Twice high, the infant mortality rate is twice as high for Palestinians as it is for Jewish Israelis and so on. So there's a whole statistical matrix one can draw on. Now, so separate could never be equal for both people. However, the fact that the Israeli government now includes the openly racist Avigdor Lieberman, a former member of the CAC party who was mentored by Meir Kahani, complicates the analogy with Jim Crow segregation. Because under this sorry chapter of U.S. history, thousands of African Americans were lynched and thousands subjected to race riots and forced to flee from their homes. Their citizenship was devalued, but even the most diehard segregationists hesitated to call for them to be stripped of their citizenship and expelled from the United States, which is what Avigdor Lieberman would like to do to Israeli Arabs who refuse to take a loyalty oath to Israel as a Jewish state. A second use, so that's the first use of the apartheid analogy within Israel itself, describing the kind of state that was set up in Israel. A second use has been in parallels drawn between the ferocity with which the anti-apartheid movement was suppressed in South Africa and Israel's repression of the unarmed First Intifada or uprising that began in December 1987. Now, Archbishop Desmond Tutu highlighted these parallels when he told a New York synagogue in 1989, quote, if you change the names, the description of what is happening in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank would be a description of what is happening in South Africa. End quote. So that's the second parallel. The way the repression is taking shape in both countries. And during the years of the First Intifada, Remember, this is an uprising which is unarmed by the entire civilian population. During those years, some 1,200 Palestinians perished, which is the per capita equivalent of 200,000 Americans, including at least 300 children, while more than 130,000 Palestinians were injured, tens of thousands were arrested, and prisoners were systematically tortured, much as in South Africa. So that's the second use. The third use of apartheid emerged in the mid-1990s, when both South Africa and Israel-Palestine at first appeared to be moving toward a settlement based on negotiated compromise. But while South Africa did dismantle the apartheid system, the Oslo Accords set up the structures for a new apartheid system in the occupied territories, complete with a dual system of documentation that resembled the South African pass system, a dual system of justice, one for settlers, one for Palestinians, a dual road system with Israel only bypass roads bisecting the territories. As Israel doubled the number of its settlers in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, the territories were increasingly being carved into Bantustan-like enclaves that gave Israel control over the best land and water resources, severed Greater Jerusalem from the West Bank, and increasingly ruled out the creation of a viable Palestinian state. Now, in the 21st century, several factors have combined to make the apartheid analogy and the methods of economic sanctions used against South African apartheid the most promising nonviolent strategy for activists to embrace. Appeals to international law and UN resolutions have appeared increasingly futile. Following the attacks of 9/11, the very existence of an Israeli occupation was being airbrushed away in the prevailing U.S. discourse, or made to seem as well-intentioned as that which the U.S. military was imposing on Iraq. It was becoming increasingly difficult to interest Americans in what was being done with their tax dollars in the occupied territories when, with each suicide bombing in Israel, post-9/11 America was reminded of just how much the two peoples have in common and why they had to stand together in the battle against terrorism. This is the context for the emergence of a fourth application of the apartheid analogy. It is grounded in the document I mentioned earlier, the document which the UN General Assembly adopted in November 1973, and I think you all have a copy of it, the International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid. The convention emphasized that the crime of apartheid, which it defined as a crime against humanity, was not exclusive to South Africa. Instead, it applied to policies and practices similar to those identified with the apartheid state of South Africa. The convention defined the crime of apartheid as inhuman acts that were committed to establish and maintain domination by one racial group or demographic group in Israel's usage over another racial group, which was systematically oppressed. Significantly, the demise of the apartheid regime in South Africa did not lead the international community to abandon this universalized application of the term. The 2002 Rome Statute establishing the International Criminal Court, which has been ratified by 102 countries, includes the crime of apartheid as one of 11 recognized crimes against humanity. As Israel's supporters vigorously attack the apartheid analogy, insisting, as does Jimmy Carter, that the state of Israel bears no resemblance to the apartheid regime of South Africa, and arguing, again like Carter, that Israeli practices are not based on racism, they cannot so easily dismiss out of hand the parallels between the practices used against Palestinians in the occupied territories and the inhuman acts listed in Article 2 of the International Convention for the Suppression of the Crime of Apartheid. And the Boston Coalition for Palestinian Rights has created an exhibit that illustrates, these are very large panels, unfortunately we couldn't put them up here, illustrating how these acts do apply to what Israel is doing. Now, the call for the creation of an international anti-apartheid movement, similar to that which helped bring apartheid to an end in South Africa, was made at the 2001 Durban Conference. The abysmal lack of action by the international community following the July 2004 International Court of Justice ruling on Israel's wall has given both the moral authority and momentum to an international movement for, quote, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS, as perhaps the only remaining meaningful nonviolent method of working for an end to the Israeli occupation and a just resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. On the first anniversary of the ICJ Wall opinion, 171 Palestinian civil society organizations issued an urgent call to the international community and to, quote, conscientious Israelis, end quote, for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions to be imposed against Israel until it ends the occupation and complies with international law and universal principles of human rights. This call was immediately endorsed by a range of organizations internationally and within the U.S. It is South Africa that has been pushing the pace. South African institutions that have been leading the call for BDS, and South African activists who have been using their personal experience of apartheid and resistance to be outspoken in their denunciations of Israel's practices. Take, for example, these words delivered by Eddie Makuwe, who is the General Secretary of the South African Council of Churches. He delivered these words on November 29, 2007, quote, "As South Africans, we have a responsibility to say to the world that we recognize apartheid when we see it. And what we see Israel doing is apartheid and worse. We South Africans who live in townships and squatter camps know what it's like to live without electricity and without water. What we don't know, however, is what it is like to live with hundreds of checkpoints, with roads that are racialized, with helicopter gunships and fighter planes flying overhead in our residential areas. We don't know what it is like to live in an open-air prison like Gaza," end quote. The war on Gaza that began on December 27, 2009 has given a vigorous push not just to street protests and acts of civil disobedience at Israeli consulates and on college campuses, but to an expansion of the campaign of BDS. And South Africa has continued to set the pace. It moved beyond the stage of issuing resolutions when the South African Transport and Allied Workers Union refused to unload the cargo from an Israeli ship docked in Durban in February 2009. In Brazil, a significant movement is being built against a free trade agreement with Israel, and in Europe and Canada, strides have been taken in the call for an academic and cultural boycott of Israel, as well as the boycott of Israeli products and divestment. The United States has seen the launch of new product boycotts, including one aimed at Motorola for its role in protecting the settlements. There's a flyer there. And BDS resolutions have been introduced at several universities. On February 7, 2009, at Hampshire College, the first American campus to divest from apartheid South Africa, Students for Justice in Palestine declared victory in their campaign to have the college divest from corporations supporting Israel's military occupation. More than 800 professors, students, and alumni had signed the petition calling for divestment in a college with an enrollment of only slightly more than 1,300 students. Now, after being leaned on, the trustees said that, in fact, their divestment action had nothing to do with this Students for Justice in Palestine. But now, what does all of this add up to? When combined with the rupture in some trade and diplomatic relations that Israel faced as a result of the Gaza war, with ongoing demands for war crimes investigations from international bodies and human rights organizations, and with Israeli military commanders potentially facing legal problems when they travel abroad, the negative exposure may be starting to have an impact. According to Sher Hever, in a posting on the website of the Alternative Information Center in Jerusalem, quote, "Israelis are beginning to see the power of BDS." To make his case, he quotes from four articles that appeared in an Israeli business magazine, The Marker, concluding that, quote, "If the momentum is maintained and strengthened, Israeli businessmen may decide to move their headquarters away from Israel or to begin to put pressure on the Israeli government to begin respecting international law and ending the occupation," end quote. It is often forgotten that it took decades for the first anti-apartheid movement, which was founded in London in 1959, to become a significant force, even though it never faced the kind of relentless, strident, orchestrated hostility that has been directed against activists for BDS. In the case of Israel, just the threat of isolation appears to be having some impact, judging from the furor against it in the United States, the response it is generating within Israel itself, and the way this single issue has dominated and divided governments at Durban 1 and Durban 2. One thing is certain, much depends on what we do here in the United States. Will we continue to subsidize an illegal military occupation with our tax dollars and remain silent while our government shields Israel from the impact of international law and allows it with impunity to violate Palestinian rights and continue to seize Palestinian land? Or will we act? The choice is ours. Thank you.